Welcome. I'm Matt Martin, sitting in for Rose Aguilar, and this is the Your Call Friday Media Roundtable, the time of the week where we talk to journalists about major stories in the week's news and how they were covered, miscovered, or undercovered. This week, the reality of a Trump presidency sunk in for Americans and the news media, and our attention has turned to the genesis of the Trump administration. Relatively mainstream Republicans like Chris Christie and Mike Rogers were pushed off the transition team, and Steve Bannon, former chief editor of Breitbart.com, a far-right website that has grown its audience with inflammatory stories tapping into sexism, homophobia, anti-Semitism, and anti-Islamic rhetoric, was named chief White House strategist. This morning, more Trump cabinet picks were announced. Retired General Michael Flynn, who has said that fear of Muslims is rational and who served as a paid analyst for the Russian government news channel RT, has been named National Security Advisor. And Alabama Senator Jeff Sessions, an outspoken opponent of the Voting Rights Act, will be Trump's nominee for Attorney General. How should journalists cover an administration that is shaping up to be more insular and extreme than any in recent memory? And how will they handle a president who built his base by attacking the media, and who shows no sign of stopping now that the election is over? Joining us to discuss these and other issues are Jeff Charlotte, Associate Professor of Literary Journalism at Dartmouth, and author of several books, including Sea Street, The Fundamentalist Threat to American Democracy, and his latest, Radiant Truths. Jeff, thanks so much for being here on Your Call today.
Hey, thanks for having me.
And also with us is Joshua Holland. He's a contributor to The Nation and a fellow at The Nation Institute. Josh, thanks so much for being here with us.
Thanks for having me, Matt. I appreciate that.
No, really appreciate it. And so we always start, as we do, because we do a lot of critical conversation about the media and its role on this program. So we like to start by talking about good things in the media, which is to say not necessarily good news, but work done well by journalists and editors and outlets. Jeff Charlotte, let's start with you. Did you read, hear, or watch something this week that impressed you that you want to let folks know about?
Yeah, it might be a piece that people have already seen, but Adrian Chen's report on the new Filipino dictator, Rodrigo Duterte, tough guy, in The New Yorker, and a piece that I think is vitally important, and in fact, I'm glad Chen could do it. I had been proposing to editors for a while, look, we got to pay attention to this guy. This guy is a vision of Trump to come, and I couldn't convince anyone that that Trump was coming or that what was happening in the Philippines was relevant to us, which is sort of the insular nation nature of a lot of magazine editors. And I guess I'm glad because he did it better than I would have. And I think it's important news to understand, as a lot of us realize, that Trump is not isolated. He's part of a really global moment. Modi in India, Duterte in Philippines, a whole host of rising right-wingers throughout Europe. There is a moment of Trumps all over the world. There's a guy known as the Trump of Burma. There's there's really no shortage of these characters, and we're going to understand them best, the threat and how to resist by reading journalism like Chen's, that's going to let us know what's going on and the parallel universes of other nations.
Well, let's talk for a moment about Duterte specifically and what you learned from this. I mean, I think through the lens of American media, to the extent that the Philippines is seen at all, he seems kind of like a caricature. You know, we get these certain moments where he says something particularly outrageous, not unlike Trump. What did you learn deeper that you'd want to convey to people or make sure that they know and want to go learn more about?
I mean, the idea of him as a caricature or as a sort of kind of comedy kind of guy, that's accurate. This guy is over the top. He loves cursing. You know, the lead of the story begins with he pushes back against reporters challenging him about his health by asking them crude sexual questions about their own lives and their spouses. But beyond all that rhetoric, we see a guy who has sort of activated a vast paramilitary scheme that has led to at least 3,000 deaths. There was no secret, and I think the other piece that I would actually call out is Masha Gessen's, the great Russian reporter Masha Gessen's piece in the New York Review of Books, which Masha Gessen, for listeners who don't know, I think she's really one of the bravest reporters on Putin. She's sort of in exile in the United States, having fled Putin. And she reminds us, you know, listen to authoritarians. Take them at their word. When they say they're going to do something, don't scoff and just say how clownish. Recognize that what we dismiss as clownish is, in fact, the threat. Take it seriously. And I think that's what you're seeing in these stories. It's parallel situation of a figure who was appealing to the same kind of challenge to the elites, and yet by setting up his own kind of far-right elite, a guy who was promising the sort of a redemption through violence, this idea that we can cleanse the nation through the violence of Duterte's drug war or through Trump's massive deportations and who knows what else.
So Jeff Charlotte recommending a couple of pieces there, Adrian Chen's piece on Rodrigo Duterte in The New Yorker and also Masha Gessen's latest essay in The New Yorker Review of Books. Josh Holland with The Nation, what would you recommend from this week's journalism to folks?
Well, one of the pieces that I think is informative about what we're facing is a piece by Paul Waldman in this morning's Washington Post. It's about how Trump tweeted out this claim that the CEO of Ford had called him up and said that a plant in Kentucky that builds Lincolns would not move to Mexico. He kind of took credit for saving those jobs, and the story appears to be entirely made up. And so this is, I think, a microcosm of a bigger issue that we're going to have to really figure out how to overcome, if we can overcome it, which is that we're living in this era of siloed media where we really have alternative universes. There's an abundance of fake news, was highly influential in this election. If you ask somebody like me, a liberal person, it's self-evident that people are protesting Trump because they're furious, because they're shocked, they're angry, they're scared. If you ask a Trump supporter, they will likely say that those are paid protesters because of a series of fake Craigslist ads. So they are probably of the opinion that that there is no popular resistance against Donald Trump's election. And, you know, you might retort, well, of course people are angry because he lost the popular vote and is taking the White House nonetheless. But, of course, they are convinced that Trump won the popular vote by significant margin. So, you know, I don't know what the answer is, but this is the challenge that we're going to have to face in the era of Trump, which is just this ability to beat the fact checkers, to spew out so many claims of success that we won't be able to keep up with it, that the mainstream press, that the institutions that used to kind of mediate the discourse are just not prepared to handle. Another piece on that same vein was by Craig Silverman at BuzzFeed. It's not a brilliant piece of journalism, but it's just fascinating that viral fake election news outperformed real news on Facebook in the final months of the election. And they did an analysis, and they showed that if you look at the period from August through Election Day, these fake news stories just dominated the engagements on Facebook, and many more people who got their news and information from Facebook were looking at blatantly fake stories. These weren't, you know, we should understand, these aren't stories that are spun. It's not that there's bias. These are stories where somebody sat down and wrote something that they knew was not true in order to influence people's views of the election, and I don't know how we're going to counter that in the coming years, but it's an important thing for people to understand.
That's Joshua Holland, contributor to The Nation, and we at Your Call will post Joshua's recommendations as well as Jeff Charlotte's on our website, yourcallradio.org. We also invite you to join the conversation. I'm Matt Martin, sitting in for Rose Aguilar this Friday. If you have a piece of journalism from this week that you want to highlight to make sure that people know about as we try to sort out the facts from the fiction in the news media, the number to call is 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK. You can also post a comment at yourcallradio.org or email feedback@yourcallradio.org. Josh and Jeff, I want to pick up on that question of fake news, because obviously it has been getting a lot of attention since Election Day. And of course, those fake news stories have not stopped coming out. And I actually want to get you to weigh in, Jeff, a bit of what Josh is pointing out. There's kind of two elements of fake news going on here. One, where you've got, you know, the president-elect who is clearly responsible for just putting forward something that is completely untrue. And you have fact checkers trying to say, well, how do we counter that? How do we make sure that that untruth doesn't go beyond, you know, our ability to counter it? And then there's the other part, which is like these, you know, websites in who knows where, acting like they're ABC or, you know, other legitimate news organizations, because they want to, you know, make clickbait. And they, you know, find that Trump supporters, Clinton supporters in some cases, depending on what the story is, they'll come click if there's news that sounds like something they want to hear. And so, Jeff, I'd just like to get you to weigh in on that and kind of what that means about the responsibility of news media and of the social media, which now we realize is the primary way people are seeing their news.
I see a couple different layers to this fake news problem. And I think first, in terms of combating it, it's always on us as journalists of the left to understand what's going on with that fake news. And I agree with Joshua exactly about some of these stories that are so influential. But you take the story, like, for instance, of the paid protesters, which is a false story. But then we go into the world of the right, and we begin to understand. And the other journalism that I would recommend this week, God help me, you should be reading Breitbart. And if you haven't been reading Breitbart, you got took by surprise, and you're going to keep getting taken by surprise. Part of left resistance is to know what these guys are thinking. And you see in that universe that when they talk about paid protesters, they're talking both about these sort of conspiracy theories of Soros, you know, Soros's minions, and they're also talking about nonprofit workers, activist organizations that a lot of people on the right didn't really know existed. And so when you hear someone is like or even from a major organization like Planned Parenthood is out protesting, they're like, you're a paid protester. Well, that's not actually accurate, but we understand that distinction, and that's maybe a fault line and a wedge we can get in there. I think the other level here is that there's not a whole lot we can do to stop that flood. So what we can, the most effective response is to flood the zone with real journalism. That's the work, and with good journalism, with strong journalism, and to be careful on the left that we hold ourselves to a fact-checking standard. One of the stories that drove me nuts throughout this campaign was the sort of established certainty that 17 federal agencies have said it is absolutely true that the Russians were behind the WikiLeaks. And then you started going through and sifting it and doing responsible journalism, and you realized no one was really quite certain, and that there's On the Media did a good bit on this, that no one really knew quite what happened. When we on the left, or the liberals who sort of did that story, when we traffic in BS, we're going to weaken our situation. I was talking to a young activist, and he was saying, look, they BS all the time. Why can't we? And I said, because we're talking to people, our constituency, those who care about democratic values, we value accuracy and honesty and so on. The same BS, you know, Trump-like BS isn't going to work for us. So let's resist that temptation and flood the zone with great journalism. And I think the idea of counting on Twitter or Facebook to ride in and save the day by changing the algorithm is a kind of a lost cause and looking to the wrong savior.
Well, Josh, do you think there's anything? I mean, obviously, there's, you know, fight the fiction with some facts. I mean, that's obviously, you know, an important thing to do and critical. That's the point of journalism. But do these conduits, whether it's Facebook or Twitter or whoever, do they have some kind of responsibility? Is there a way you think they could intervene that doesn't, you know, be without them doing like, oh, well, we'll choose what the truth is?
Yeah, I do. I guess I disagree with Jeff a little bit in that I think that they have huge platforms with, you know, a billion Facebook users. They should have some responsibility. They should have, you know, at least an attempt to take away the monetary incentives, right? So I think that we're looking at some fake news from people who are ideologically devoted to a cause, but, you know, there's been some reporting on these fake news farms that they don't care about advancing Donald Trump or Hillary Clinton. they are in it for the clicks, for the ad revenues, and I think that depriving them of the financial incentive is something that the social media sites can do and should do, and that's not the same as you know, taking a viewpoint or saying, well, we can't have conservative sites or liberal sites or whatever. You can take those fake news sites and just take away the financial incentive.
I want to ask Jeff Charlotte, since you were talking about how it's important right now for people to be looking at what Breitbart is and to understand that, you're obviously someone who has followed Breitbart. What, knowing now that Steve Bannon is going to be at the highest level in the White House, what will you be watching for in what's coming out from the Trump White House and, you know, connecting it to what you understand about how Breitbart worked?
I think maybe the most interesting and misunderstood thing about Steve Bannon, Breitbart, the so-called alt-right, the white supremacist sort of movement that's been branded that way, is this very dangerous idea that they are sort of a secular alternative to the religious right, that they are somehow at real odds with the more pious religious right brokers who are well represented in the Trump team already. Another great piece of journalism, BuzzFeed, I think it was Lester Fetter, I think his name is, produced, uncovered an old Bannon speech from 2014 at the Vatican, in which he lays out really the ideas motivating Breitbart. And, you know, parts of them read like excerpts from the manifesto of the Oslo Kings, Breivik, who, you know, may remember, killed some 70-some innocent Norwegians in his anti-Muslim campaign. They invoke this idea of Vienna, 1493. They see themselves as this grand culture war with Islam. That's what I think we should pay attention to most, is the really kind of apocalyptic dreams of Bannon, and not actually to get distracted by what he's trying to distract you with. They want sensational headlines, they want clickbait, and all that kind of stuff. But don't let us make the mistake of thinking they're clowns like that, or that they're just sort of little boys who like to be naughty. That world is motivated by a strong ideological vision, and what's even more damning is that it lines up so neatly with the vision of the religious right. So we have this convergence of far-right movements right now.
Can we talk about how that, you know, it's been called the alt-right. Obviously, this is a, you know, recently created term in our politics. But because there obviously are these really close connections between people who are going to be very important in this White House and these figures, actually, I've gotten a couple of communications from listeners to our station, KALW, about an interview that was on our air yesterday, where Kelly McEvers, on All Things Considered, was talking to Richard Spencer, who's a white supremacist who has claimed to coin the term alt-right. And it was very interesting because she kind of sets up the interview by saying there's a warning, there can be words and phrases that may be offensive, but this group has influence. We should hear, you know, we think you should hear what the alt-right is and what it wants from a Trump administration. She went on to say a few other things during the interview. But I'd be interested, Josh and then Jeff, how does the news media, particularly mainstream outlets like NPR, how do they address the reality of organizations like these, of speakers like these, and without normalizing them or taking on their way of viewing the world? I mean, this is the challenge of both presenting their ideas, saying this is really happening, and then not to seem like they're saying like, oh, and that's just, you know, part of our wonderful spectrum of political belief. Why don't you go ahead, Josh?
You know, I hate to be pessimistic, but I'm not sure that they're capable of doing that, because the conventions of political reporting are so deeply entrenched in the mainstream media and the non-partisan media. And I think that, you know, just the word alt-right, I mean, it obscures what we're talking about. It sounds like alt-country music or something like that. We're talking about white supremacists. We're talking about Islamophobes. We're talking about these institutions that deplore, you know, the pluralism that is the basis of our democracy, and And just calling them, just giving them a euphemism is already problematic. And yes, you know, you have to report on them, but you can, I think that there's a real challenge in the coming years to call out what's going on in plain terms that people can understand and not use euphemisms like that and not say that, you know, these are equally valid viewpoints and we just have to show both sides, you know, the opinions of both sides.
And Jeff Charlotte?
Yeah, I agree with Josh that I think NPR and a lot of mainstream media is really not prepared for this. This, as he says, these conventions are formed over years and years and years and have obscured really problematic far-right movements in the past by sort of attempting to put it in the sort of spectrum of reasonable disagreement. I think the question of what to do, what to call this movement, and I come from a sort of a history of covering right-wing movements where one of the things I think is sort of valuable is to pay attention to the language that people use in these movements. So although I think it's a fairly fascistic movement, I don't think it's really sufficient or adequate or covers everything to call them fascists. And it undermines the attempt to describe what they're doing. I also just don't think NPR is going to come to the point where they're saying it today in the news from the fascists. I think it is fair to call them the militant right, which is exactly what they are. They are they're not actually all that different than the establishment right, and I don't want to actually emphasize those disconnections. I want to emphasize the connections between the Republican Party that has brought us to this phase and the Steve Bannons of the world. This isn't that great a divide between Paul Ryan and Steve Bannon. It's a divide of style. It's not a divide of aims. It's not a divide of white supremacy. It is a divide of methods. And when we read Breitbart and we see their advocacy for militarization, for their enthusiasm for paramilitaries, their sort of giddy reaction to violence, I think you can call them the militant right without crossing the borders that mainstream media like NPR are bound to respect.
That's Jeff Charlotte. He's an associate professor of literary journalism at Dartmouth, author of several books, including C Street, The Fundamentalist Threat to American Democracy, and his latest book is called Radiant Truths. Also with us on today's Your Call Media Roundtable is Joshua Holland, contributor to The Nation, and we are taking your calls in this hour. I want to go straight to Heidi in San Francisco. Heidi, good to have you on the program.
Yes, hello. I live in San Francisco, and I work with the opera, and my sister lives in Miami, Florida, and the other one's in Kentucky, and we've been brainstorming of what can, you know, what articles and things can help us hopefully turn this around, and there's one that my sister found. It's from the Huffington Post, and it was written on 11/10/2016 by Douglas Anthony Cooper, and the title of it is called The Electoral College Was Designed to Prevent Trump. You can make this happen, and it goes down and it explains everything, and then there's a little link where you could go, and it says flip the 37, and it tells you who and what states to write before they do their electoral vote on December 19th. And many of them have already changed their vote and their way to vote for Hillary, so I think it's worth a shot in the dark that if we all just, you know, do these letters and they have alias on flip the 37 to actually look that up and write the letters.
Heidi, thank you so much for the call. We will post that piece at yourcallradio.org, and we'll get a response from Josh and Jeff right after this break. You're listening to the Your Call Media Roundtable. We'll be back after this.
This is Your Call on KALW Local Public Radio. If you have a perspective you haven't heard in today's discussion or a question that you feel needs to be answered, please join the conversation by calling 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK, toll-free number. You can also send an email to feedback@yourcallradio.org or post a comment or question to the show's website, yourcallradio.org, or tweet us at yourcallradio. Coming up at 11, it's Inflection Point here on 91.7 KALW.
Hi, I'm Matt Martin, sitting in for Rose Aguilar. This is the Your Call Media Roundtable. We do podcast our show. You can find more information about how to sign up at yourcallradio.org. On Monday, we're going to bring you a conversation that Rose had with UCLA historian of Native America, Benjamin Madley, about his new book, An American Genocide. This is really an important new piece of history about California in its early years in the United States. And on Tuesday, we're going to bring back a conversation with geography professor Reese Jones about his new book, Violent Borders, Refugees, and the Right to Move. If you ever have a show idea for us, we always welcome them at feedback@yourcallradio.org. That's feedback@yourcallradio.org. You can also leave comments at yourcallradio.org. You can do that now here on our media roundtable. We will be checking those and reading them on the air. Joining us on today's program is Josh Holland, contributor to The Nation, and also Jeff Charlotte, associate professor of journalism at Dartmouth. And I want to bring Heidi's point talking about the Electoral College, obviously, with this once again, where we're having the popular vote go to one candidate and the Electoral College apparently, you know, swinging quite far the other direction, that disparity there. A lot of people are asking how this process works, trying to understand it, both what its original purposes were and how it operates now. And I just want to go to you, Josh Holland. When you hear Heidi, you know, reading about this piece in the Huffington Post, trying to take some kind of action there, what do you think?
Well, I mean, I signed the petition as an expression of my dismay, but it's certainly not something that's going to happen. And I would also point out that it would be dangerous if it did happen, because you have a lot of Trump supporters who are angry people who believe that they have been betrayed by the establishment in all sorts of different ways, and I would be very, very concerned about an outbreak of violence if electors were to flip and give it to Hillary Clinton. You know, she would also be completely illegitimate and have a Republican Congress. It would be a muddled nightmare. I think that we have to think about this more in the long term. There is something called the National Popular Vote Compact. This is the Electoral College is in the Constitution, so in order to eliminate it entirely, you need to get a constitutional amendment. That's very difficult. You need two-thirds of both chambers of Congress and then ratification by 75% of the states. But there is this National Popular Vote Compact where states pass laws saying that they will give their electors to whoever wins the national popular vote. I believe it's been passed by, 11 states representing 165 electoral college votes. Once it gets to 270, we will have effectively eliminated the electoral college. That's something people should support.
I want to read an email that came in from a listener at feedback@yourcallradio.org. That's from Bob. He says, "This is what electing a racist man to the presidency looks like. The appointment of Jeff Sessions to Attorney General, a man who's made racist comments and whose positions on things like the Voting Rights Act will most assuredly take this country back 40 years. What can we as citizens do to encourage our senators to block this appointment?" And I think the whole question of how the Democrats are going to respond to Trump in the first weeks and months of this administration be very interesting. So I want to get response to that, but I also want to hear from Herb, who's calling in from Oakland. Herb, welcome to your call.
Yeah, I had a question, but first of all, I want to commend the panel. I'm a person who's called up over the years, going all the way back to the Iraq War, saying that the news is not the news media are not advocates enough for democracy. And I did hear a quote recently which kind of gets the quandary of the media in a very interesting perspective, saying that there's a difference between the balance and the truth. And the media, particularly NPR, which makes me grit my teeth often, is often bend over backwards to be balanced. In this situation, where I see the rise of fascism in this country, I think that the media has to think about what is it doing to protect democracy. Two things. Your show started off with media that listeners would want to applaud. Just even this morning, I thought the New York Times article on the real facts of how many bad people, Trump's term, bad persons, there are that would ought to, criminals that ought to be deported among Latino Americans. Something like, you know, he's talking about 3 million people. That is a catastrophic number of people. The actual numbers are something like when you boil it down to like non-felonious crimes, it's something like either 20,000 or 200,000. I forget what it was. Plenty of people still, but nothing like the kind of numbers that he's suggesting, particularly the kind of numbers that would have people knocking at our doors, trying to drag people away off to buses to go to Mexico. So that was, I think, positive reporting.
Herb, do you have a question?
I do have a question. One of your speakers talked to the difference between fascism and the alt-right. To me, it feels like how is that not an academic distinction?
Jeff Charlotte, I think that was you.
Matt, I'm sorry, if you can just rephrase the question. The volume's going out on the caller.
Yeah, no, so Herb is asking, you're talking about some kind of a distinction between talking about fascism or talking about the alt-right. How would you, I mean, he's saying, is that just an academic distinction, or is it meaningful? And if so, how would you describe it?
No, it's not an academic distinction at all. The mistake that I think the left has been making again and again is to look at the right as monolithic and to see all kinds of bad as one kind of bad. There's more than one kind of evil under the sun. And if we're going to fight back, if we're going to find the fault lines, if we're going to find the cracks in that machine, then we need to identify the distinctions. We need to recognize the fascists in the Trump coalition, and we need to recognize the very significant role of the establishment and the Trump coalition, the corporatists, the white supremacists. There's all these varieties of far right. And if we just sort of say it's all fascism, well, then we don't know where to put pressure. We don't know where to push back. So I think that's, it's not only not an academic distinction, it is the distinction we must make right now. And I heard enough of the callers to hear that he was talking about Jeff Sessions and Michael Flynn. It's important for us to understand who Sessions is and who Flynn is. They're not the same character. They represent different strands. That's going to be valuable information for us as we struggle.
Well, I'm interested just, Jeff, because, you know, Mike Pence has, you know, when he became the vice presidential candidate for Trump, there was a certain amount of attention to who is this guy. But now it's, you know, obviously like each of these nominees for various positions in the cabinet are going to get a lot of scrutiny, at least for the moment. But Mike Pence has gotten relatively little scrutiny. And I know you're someone who's followed the Christian right very carefully, done a lot of deep reporting about it. Situate him for us.
I called Mike Pence in 2010 at the end of my book. I said, look, you know, maybe down the road to 2016, we're going to see Mike Pence in the White House. And
well, I guess congratulations.
I didn't guess as Trump, but I saw him coming. And, you know, he's a guy that they've been building up for a long time. And that, again, like what these distinctions between the strands of the right, that fight between the sort of the New York, New Jersey gang, the Christies and so on, and Pence and what he represents, as both a kind of populist fundamentalism, but you look at the people he brought in. Most interesting figure, not getting even less attention, is Ed Meese on the transition team and in charge of the Office of Management and Budget, right? Ed Meese, who was the Reagan-era attorney general, left under a cloud of scandal, but never really left. Has always been in Washington as a broker between so-called business conservatives and social conservatives. And those guys, they work together through a kind of a religious organization called the Fellowship. They have this idea of the sort of the slow grind build toward power, which they've been achieving. It's worth noting the people in the Trump coalition who aren't part of that. And that's possibly an area where we can put pressure on, and we can hope for conflict within the Trump administration. That's something that we want to be looking for, because we want to see it crumble from within as well as from the pressure we're going to put on it.
That's Jeff Charlotte, professor of literary journalism at Dartmouth, author of several books, including C Street, The Fundamentalist Threat to American Democracy, and his latest book, Radiant Truths. Also with us on today's Your Call Media Roundtable, Joshua Holland, contributor to The Nation. I'm Matt Martin, sitting in for Rose Aguilar. If you'd like to join us, you have a piece of excellent journalism you'd like to highlight, or a question or comment about the week's news coverage, the number to call is 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. And I want to share a couple of emails that have come in. Bo in San Francisco says, the blizzard of phony stories will remain a key component of the Trump administration, orchestrated by Bannon and his confederates. Part of the strategy is to keep normal news organizations busy fact-checking and debunking these pieces of propaganda. Also an email from Denise in San Francisco, who says, did the Obama administration help create and pave the way for Trumpism by catering to Wall Street from the beginning of his administration? Did deporting 2.5 million immigrants help? Did funding the continuing work on the barrier along the Mexican border help? Joshua, you want to pick up anywhere along there? Obviously, just partly bringing forward the voices of folks, but I'm sure you have somewhere you'd like to respond.
Given me the easy one. I want to go back to something that was touched on earlier,
sure,
and then we didn't kind of dig into it, which is how the Democrats should respond to the Trump regime. There is a big debate going on right now about whether they can work with him on some things that are vaguely within the progressive wish list, like an infrastructure spending plan. And the counter argument is that, you know, they should adopt basically the Mitch McConnell plan, which is to obstruct at every turn within whatever power they have. Obviously, that's limited. And the ultimate result being that people blame the president for dysfunction in Washington. My own view on this is that Trump only won by undermining an already fragile democracy. He won with voter suppression. He won with the intervention of the FBI, with other actors, WikiLeaks, dribbling out campaign emails for the final 6 weeks. And I think that it's really, really important that Democrats do whatever they can to highlight the fact that this is that his legitimacy is dubious. That, you know, we live in a democracy. Legitimacy is supposedly conferred by majority rule with protection for minorities, and both of those things are at risk at this point. And I fall squarely on the side that they have to pull a Mitch McConnell.
Well, since this program is about journalism, how it responds to these questions, how we cover what's going on in any part of the political spectrum, what do you think? I mean, where as a journalist now, in terms of covering the Democrats, what do you think it's important to be paying attention to?
Well, this is what's important to be paying attention to. In the 2018 midterms, you have 33 seats up, 25 are held by Democrats, 9 of those are in states that Trump won. There's going to be an enormous amount of pressure to from those vulnerable Democrats to get along with Trump, to try to find areas of commonality with Trump, and it's important to look at the bigger picture here. Trump's ascendancy, his regime, is a threat to our pluralistic order, and this isn't politics as usual. So you can't start making horse trades in order to protect your chances to be reelected in the face of such a dire threat. This isn't politics as usual, and I think that we need to keep emphasizing that. This is not a generic Republican. It's not Mitt Romney. It's not, McCain. This is a serious threat to how we understand our country to function.
And Jeff Charlotte, I know that we have to let you go shortly, but before we do, when you're looking at this this week, what we're seeing emerging from the Trump administration, any last thoughts from your research, from your own reporting about what we should be paying close attention to and where you think journalists can be going next for their stories on this administration?
Well, I think maybe if I could just sort of pick up on something Josh said and clarify, said something I said earlier about I didn't think Twitter or Facebook were actually going to bring the changes we need in terms of fake news and so on. And, you know, there's the idea that they have the responsibility to do this. And I think we have the idea that the Democratic Party has a responsibility to stand in opposition to this. I'm not confident. I'm very confident that these institutions aren't going to do the job. They haven't been doing the job. They're not designed to do the job. Twitter and Facebook aren't going to do the right thing. They're going to do the money-making thing, and so is the Democratic Party. It's what it's done. There will be outliers, and there will be heroes and so on, but the work of making democracy it's not going to happen at that institutional level. I do think it can happen at the journalistic level in work like Josh's and work like all these journalists out there who are paying attention to the many, many small stories. One of the things I'm going to do, though, is put aside for now the fight between the ongoing argument between left and liberal. I've participated in it from a left side. At this point, I'll stand with anybody who wants to stand against Trump. This is, as Josh says, this is not the way it was. Mitch McConnell was opposing a president who was well within the norms. McConnellism, I don't think, is going to work against Trump. We need all hands on deck. So my focus is not going to be on the failures of the Democratic Party, which I think is kind of a given. My focus is going to be on exposing as many of the fault lines as I can in the Trump administration and supplying those of us who want to get out there in the streets and be loud with the information that we need
Jeff,
to make noise.
Before you go, I wanted to ask specifically about that. I mean, you've covered right-wing movements of many stripes. What do you think the role is about, or the approach that you're seeing to how, you know, the liberal and left in the streets movements that are happening now in response to Trump? What's the story there that's being told? What story should you think can be told that might not be being told?
To be honest, I'm not interested. I am interested in that story. I'm for it. But I'd like to see us devoting our resources and our energy to identifying this big monstrosity in front of us that we've done a terrible job of watching out for, right? So I find reporting about protests here and there and everywhere, I find it encouraging. That's valuable. That's good. But I don't think that's the story that is the most important. That's not where we need to be putting the work now. That's the story that the left and liberals as well, to a certain extent, have been telling themselves for a long time. We love to encourage ourselves. That's good. Now let's move on. You know, the monstrosity is here, and we don't understand it. We don't know its moving parts, and we need to. So that's just outweighs any other concern to me.
Jeff Charlotte, thank you so much for joining us here on the Your Call Media Roundtable.
Thank you.
Really appreciate it. Jeff Charlotte is an associate professor of literary journalism at Dartmouth, author of a number of books, most recently Radiant Truths. With us for the rest of the hour is Josh Holland, contributor to The Nation. Let's go to our next caller, who is Harvey in Berkeley. Harvey, welcome to Your Call.
Hi. I wrote a two-minute statement about the coming of the Trump energy policy, and I'd like to read it to you and your vast KALW audience.
If you could just go to your main point, Harvey, about, and particularly if you have any kind of question around it, I'd rather not you read a two-minute statement.
Okay. Well, I just feel that that Trump and his administration are they're owned by the new.
Harvey, I am afraid we have lost you. If you call right back, we'll get you back on the air. I apologize for that. Josh Holland, I think that Harvey was going to at least in part talk about connections between Trump and his administration and the energy industry, perhaps specifically nuclear, but it certainly goes beyond that. One thing I've been noticing in relation to coverage of the Dakota Access Pipeline is that, you know, there's actually, you know, a bit more reporting happening on the ground for mainstream outlets. But the fact that Trump appears to have investments in energy transfer partners is not one of the things that seems to come up in most of those stories.
I have not looked into those connections.
Yeah.
You know, I think that the big thing is the Paris Agreement.
Sure.
Trump campaigned on canceling it on day one. I've spoken to some climate climatologists, climate activists, who, and I've seen a kind of a divide opening up in terms of the degree of apocalyptic views of the Trump administration. So one school says that he is, you know, going to be elected with a minority and has the opportunity and will, in fact, destroy the Paris Compact and get us back onto track to see global temperatures rising on average over 4 degrees Celsius. The other side says that, you know, it was one thing to campaign on destroying Paris, but the international momentum is so great and the backlash against the United States pulling out would be so so obvious and so vehement, and we might see sanctions on our exports, a carbon tax put on our exports, that not even the Trump campaign, not even the Trump administration would go through with it. This, for me, is one of the vital questions of the next 4 years, is how much of the campaign rhetoric he follows through on and how much, you know, wiser heads prevail because he is, in fact, governing and not campaigning and has to own the consequences of his actions. And that's true for dismantling the Affordable Care Act. It's true for a number of different policy areas that he spoke to on the campaign trail.
Let's go next to Mark in Berkeley. Mark, welcome to your call.
Thank you for the show. I wanted to address the corruption in the Democratic Party. I mean, we know that Wasserman Schultz was favoring and helping rig the election for Hillary against Bernie. And then there was the later issue with Bazile giving the questions from the debate to Hillary. I mean, because public money is involved in elections, I mean, aren't these crimes, I mean, shouldn't these be prosecuted? I mean, I'll take my answer on the air, but I really feel that this is a level of criminal activity that we should not just ignore. Thank you.
Thanks, Mark. Josh?
Well, I mean, no, there was no criminal activity exposed in any of this stuff. I mean, the big case against Debbie Wasserman Schultz, it's clear that Debbie Wasserman Schultz violated party rules by not adhering to a strict neutrality between the campaigns. But party rules and the criminal code are not the same thing. I would also point out that, you know, the idea that the election was rigged is problematic for the primaries were rigged is problematic on a number of different grounds. I think it would be more credible if the race were closer. Clinton never led by less than 7 points in the 538 national average of polls. She won the popular vote by about 14 points. It's hard for me to see that a few more debates would have changed that. The other problem is that the two candidates had very clear coalitions that stuck with them from beginning to end. Sanders appealed to younger voters, liberal voters, urban voters. Hillary Clinton, basically, her coalition was older people of color, women, more rural voters, moderates. So it's hard to understand for me how the DNC could influence one group of voters and not the other. I think that the DNC needs to learn some lessons from 2016, but I think the degree to which they influence the outcome is often really exaggerated.
I want to share an email that just came in from Daniela, who says, "What about the media's responsibility in using the term alt-right? By overusing this term, the media is supporting it. So how about calling what it really is neo-Nazism or the white nationalist right? By using this misleading term, again, the media is failing in doing its job as it did in covering the elections." Joshua?
Yeah, I mentioned that earlier. I think it's white nationalism. I mean, that we have a term for this, and you know, Jeff Charlotte, who I respect greatly, he said that we need to keep pointing out that Trumpism is just an extension of conservatism, a natural culmination of conservatism. I'm of two minds on this. In the one sense, that's correct. You know, we have a Republican Party, a mainstream establishment that has pushed these voter ID laws, that has adopted a lot of, for many, many years, has adopted a lot of racially divisive rhetoric. On the other hand, I think that there is something new here. I think that, just for example, the rise in anti-Semitism and overt expressions of anti-Semitism is new and does have to do with the Breitbart, Bannon, white supremacist movement. That's not something that a lot of us have seen before.
Got an email from Sheila who says, for months and months, the New York Times was showing all the terrible things Trump had done, and I wrote to them saying they're preaching to the choir, or that is to say, liberal-minded folks. I asked the Times to find a way to reach out to the right wing, which I am sure, for the most part, don't read the New York Times. And even now, here on Your Call, are we again doing the same thing? Is there a way to reach people who don't agree with us? This is obviously, in our kind of siloed politics, siloed media, this is a big issue. Any thoughts you have, Josh? We've got about 1 minute before the close of the show.
It's a daunting challenge. You know, this is what they call it, motivated reasoning, where people who feel strongly about an issue ignore evidence to the contrary, embrace evidence that reinforces their worldview. I don't know that there's an obvious path around that.
Josh Holland, I want to thank you so much for joining us. Joshua Holland is a contributor to The Nation, fellow with The Nation Institute, and it's been great to have you as our guest here on the Your Call Media Roundtable.
Thanks for having me, Matt.
Thanks a lot. I'm Matt Martin, sitting in for Rose Aguilar, who will be returning soon. You can always join our conversation online at yourcallradio.org. Thanks to everyone who called or emailed, and I apologize that we can't get to everyone. So much to talk about in just a single hour. But we will put a link to web resources at our website, yourcallradio.org. I'm Matt Martin. Thanks for listening. On the next Your Call, hear Rose Aguilar's conversation with historian Benjamin Madley about his groundbreaking and heartbreaking book, An American Genocide. It tells the bloody story of the early years of U.S. rule in California and assembles an unprecedented record of the killings and massacres by the U.S. military, state militias, and ordinary citizens that reduced the native population in California by 80% in just 25 years. It's a deep dive into California's Indian catastrophe. On the next Your Call with Rose Aguilar and you.
Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To listen to past shows or sign up for our podcast, visit yourcallradio.org. Laura Flynn produces the show, Malihe Razazan is senior producer, Matt Martin is executive producer, and Rosalie Atkinson is our intern. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer, and David LaTulipe is our studio engineer. Our theme music is performed and composed by Live Human. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.